You're listening to the Analuia Podcast, where faith and animation collide. Each episode, we'll discuss the various topics in animated movies and TV shows, while also sharing our thoughts and opinions as they relate to faith and spirituality. Get ready to raise a hallelujah. It's time for Analuia.
And you're locked into another episode of the Analuia Podcast. My name is Josh, and on this Memorial Day weekend, at the time of this recording, I'm with my lovely wife, Rebecca, who can better skip rope than I can.
You mean, yeah, jump rope?
Yeah, jump rope. Yeah. They call it skipping over in...
In Australia.
In Australia, yeah.
And other parts of the world, I'm sure. But the reason Josh says that is because we've been doing this exercise program that is led by... people who live in Australia. And so we have this interval training where they said you can do skipping or star jumps or stairs, running up and down stairs. And I was like, so, okay, star jumps. I'm pretty sure that's jumping jacks, which it is. And then skipping took me a long time to figure out. Yeah, oh, it's jump rope.
Right. Because I'm like, skipping. Do you just skip?
Yeah, like, that's what I thought. I was like, are we just going to skip around? I don't know. But yeah, I haven't jump roped since I think I was in elementary school.
I was very determined. I'm like, I just want to get three in a row and just progress from there.
That's your goal. That's a good goal, Josh.
Yeah, but you did like a lot. Like, you posted a video on social media a while back, you and your jump rope expertise.
Well, yeah, well, it was the first time in a long time that I've posted anything. And I was like, I might as well. Here's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Jump rope.
The last time I jump roped before we started doing this was like in elementary school, where we had like the jump rope competitions as far as field day.
Oh, yeah. Oh, the competitions. Some of those kids, they were like doing double jumps, triple jumps, and like dance routines with all of these jump ropes. Craziness. I mean, it's really impressive.
It's like, we get it. You're the best. Go on. You won already.
Well, little kids, they have so much energy. I think that's why it works for them. That's why they do it in like fifth grade.
Right. Well, I'm very excited for this episode. I know I say that about each time that we have a guest on.
We're always excited.
But I know. But let's go ahead and introduce our guests. So, Becca, if you'll do the honors, as always.
So today we have author Judy Liu. Judy is, she works in compliance in Texas, though she previously taught English around the rice fields of Japan, which is very interesting. Before her professional career, she studied history and Asian studies, focusing on education, pre-modern China, and East Asian family dynamics. She's working to publish her first book as a passion project to meaningfully add to Asian American literature and enrich young adult genre by normalizing characters of different backgrounds in adventure young adult stories for future generations. Outside of work, Judy enjoys chats in a coffee shop, dancing with her teammates, bothering her sister, protecting her own space, being a plant mom, yes, solidarity, and silently watching her low maintenance fish tanks. Welcome to the show, Judy.
Yes. Woo. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited. Thank you for that introduction. Like, hearing you guys talking about jump roping reminded me of, you mentioned me teaching in Japan. They have this whole day, like, you know, we have field day. They have a field day too. And yeah, they're doing like crazy feats, like climbing towers, like tug of war, jump rope, skip rope, whatever that is.
Yeah. That's awesome. Isn't it called, is it like the Sports Day Festival? Is that what it's called over there? Okay.
Yes, Sports Day Festival. If I remember correctly, I think in Japanese, it's like Undokai, which is like exercise meeting, I think literally. Oh. It's a big event.
Yeah, that's what, okay. The only reason I know anything about that is from anime. Is that accurate? Like what they show in
pretty
anime?
Accurate.
Is it? Okay, yeah. Cool.
Frankly, like I always thought anime was very, I don't know. I thought it was, some of it was made believe to be enticing. And then when I lived in Japan, I was like, oh no, like this is real. It's very accurate. I mean, I think that's why they have a whole genre called slice of life, right? Because it's actually very accurate to life there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, other than like the fighting stuff and like superpowers, like that stuff. I mean, maybe.
Yeah.
maybe.
Got some undercover Super Saiyans running around.
That's awesome. That's really cool to know, though, that that is accurate, like the slice of life kind of stuff, so that you get a real glimpse into what life is like there in other cultures. That's really cool.
So, Judy, we want to have our audience get to know you a little bit better. So we're going to go ahead and jump right into our interview.
So first things first, we'd love to hear a little bit more about you and your upbringing and just kind of who you are. What made you you?
Yeah, what made Judy Judy?
That's great.
Yeah. So I believe they would call us second generation American because my parents immigrated over here from Taiwan. Born and raised here. I have a sister, a younger sister. I think being like Taiwanese, Chinese American really makes up a big part of my identity. At home, we spoke mostly Mandarin. Went to Chinese school on the weekends, and that's kind of where we met a lot of our friends. And then you speak English at school, or I spoke English with my sister, but then Mandarin with my parents. And I remember back when I was younger, I definitely did not like weekend school because it was like, oh, you know, all my other American friends are out skipping rope, like on the lawn on the weekends, or they're out like, you know, doing things. And I'm here at school, like writing Chinese characters a bajillion times. But as I've gotten older, and I think a lot of people who grew up similarly to how I did probably would agree with this, is that we're pretty grateful to our parents for making us do that and go through that, because now we are equipped with a second language. So yeah, that's how I grew up. And then I went to school all in Texas. I was born in New York, but I don't remember that. Went to school all in Texas for university. I stayed in Texas as well. After that, I got a job. It was very boring. I loved the people, but it was very boring. And so just kind of in a rage, but not really in a rage, but just like, you know, I wanted something different. I went to teach English abroad in Japan. And they put me on the western coast of Japan in a prefecture called Ishikawa. It was really difficult at first, definitely. And I went like barely knowing any Japanese. But, you know, you pick up some, you start making friends. It turned out to be a really great experience. Family really wanted me to come back. So came back after a year and found a job. And have been working in, you mentioned the compliance field for a bit. And compliance is really just a fancy word for saying like, we just make sure that companies are following the laws within like internally or in how they conduct business. So a lot of times the compliance division is combined with the legal division. It just depends on how a company is set up. That's me.
So it's interesting that you chose Japan rather than Taiwan. What made you make that decision?
No, I mean, that's a great question. I did think about it. Because even though I am relatively fluent in Mandarin, I definitely struggle reading and writing, and I could be better with Mandarin. I think at home and with a lot of my friends here, we speak in Chinglish. So it's like Chinese English combined. You like say a little bit and then you throw in like elevator because you don't know how to say elevator in Mandarin. But yeah, so definitely I thought about going to Taiwan or even China really because I thought it could really strengthen my grasp on the language. But it was really just luck of the draw where I was looking at different sorts of programs that existed. And the Japanese program is one that is the one I looked at was like run by the government. It's been around for 30 and I think 35 years now. Yeah, just well known. And they would cover all of my costs in terms of like flying me out there, flying me back when I was done, finding a place for me, which is really hard for a foreigner. I think it's the same case in Korea as well. I'm not sure about Taiwan, but in Japan, it's really hard for a foreigner to find a place without having to put down like a mass amount of money, because I'm not sure if this is the reason, but what I hear from my Japanese friends is that landlords are afraid that foreigners would just run or like leave. Which I'm like, we put in so much effort to even come here. Like, we're not just going to leave. But, I get it. So it's really hard for a foreigner to find a place. So knowing that the program would help us find a place, make sure we're situated, help us apply for the resident card and everything, it just seemed like a program that covered everything. And so I applied to it. And even though it was in Japan, I had taken like a few Japanese courses in university and I wasn't very keen on it because, I mean, my teacher was pretty tough and all the people in my class. I don't know if this has happened for you guys before, but where you go into the class and you're like excited to learn, and then turns out a lot of people already know the stuff.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I've been there.
Yeah. So that's what happened. So I wasn't really keen on it. But yeah, it just so happened that this program was really, I thought was a good program. So I applied, went to Japan.
Cool. That sounds awesome. Yeah. There's a lot of factors that go into making decisions. That sounded like really good reasons to make that because yeah, it is hard to find places. I get that. I actually went to go live abroad in England for a year.
Wow. And
yeah, it was so much fun. But I went to go get really, I went there to get my master's degree, but really it was like the master's was an excuse to go live there.
I love it. Yeah. Yeah.
So but yeah, so that was really fun. I studied, art history and visual culture. So like, what a perfect place to study art history. So it was great. But yeah, they, of course, now thinking about it, they didn't really help me do or find places to live. I had to find that out on my own. Now that I realize, well, they had like dorms, but they were really expensive. And I was like, oh, I don't know about that. And just by happenstance, I ended up, really random story and sidetracked from like your story here, but I ended up going there for 2 weeks, I think, before starting school. I went in like June and school was starting in like September, I think. And so I was like, okay, I'm going to go get my bearings. I just like went by myself. Like, it's crazy.
Oh my gosh.
Thankfully, they speak English obviously over there. And so that was a big help. So I just like wandered around for 2 weeks basically, in London, and I came across this church that I ended up going to and became my church, and just wandered into like a Tuesday night study group. Basically, there's like a small group setting, met a couple of people there, and, someone that I met there actually had a connection to a hostel that like, yeah, that they only, it was a hostel for young women specifically, and it was run by Spanish nuns. And I know it, this is like really complex. I tell this story and I'm like, this sounds too crazy.
That's what I thought when you first told me. I'm
right?
Like, oh, hey, no.
So that's where I ended up staying. I lived there for a year with these Spanish nuns, and most of the girls that were there were from Spain, but they were from everywhere. There was one girl from China and Poland was another one. And anyway, they were just from like all over the place. So it was just a really cool hodgepodge. And I got to be right off the high street, Kensington, which is like really, really, really close to Kensington Palace. So it was like... It was amazing. It was a God thing for sure of how I ended up there living life. It was amazing.
Yeah. I mean, you wouldn't have known about it if you didn't find this church like randomly and join them. Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. It was so random. I was just like going where Holy Spirit said. I was like, yeah, sure. Cool. I'll go into this little garden. Oh, it's a church. That's cool. Why don't you go see what they're doing over there in that building? I'm like, well, all right, cool. I'm not normally that bold of a person, but I was just like wandered in. I was like, hey, what you guys doing?
You're like, hey, I'm Christian.
Yeah, right, exactly. I'm new here. Oh, man. So yeah, fun story.
Wow. Wait, speaking of which, I totally forgot. I did grow up Christian. But I think we went to like Baptist churches and stuff, but kind of non-denominational, I think. In university, I was in a fellowship. And then you talking about like stumbling upon a church in a foreign country reminded me that I had a few expat friends who were Christian. When I first went to Japan, they brought me to a church in Kanazawa, Japan, which was like the city very close to where I lived. Yeah, very interesting. There was a sick person. So Sikhism, he was there. And I asked him, I was like, oh, are you, you know, why are you here? Just curious. And I mean, it was interesting because he was saying like Sikhism is all about like learnings and he just wanted to be here to learn. And I was like, oh, cool. Okay. And then there were like old Japanese people who also attended. And, you know, I think they were Christian. I think probably like they went to Christian schools growing up in their childhood or something. But a lot of people told me that they were there to practice English because it was like one of the few churches that had like English speakers. And I was like, oh, very interesting. It was very open. I think we had a few Pentecostal people in as well. It's just, but it's interesting.
Yeah, that sounds, I've never heard of Sikhism before.
Yeah, it's from India, from Punjab.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, that sounds like it's probably, it sounds like it's fairly closely aligned with Buddhism, right? Because they're all about, Buddhism is all about enlightenment and learning and knowledge, right?
Okay. Yeah, I can see the tie actually. And frankly, I feel like a lot of religions do have like a lot of the same or similar like undertones.
Right.
I would say so. I think, in my opinion anyway, I think that's because we're all looking for the one true source, and that is God. That is Jesus. It makes sense that there would be other sort of spinoffs, if you will, from the original, but you can't beat the original.
Yeah, because we interpret everything differently. So,
yeah. What was it? What was religion like over there in Japan?
So speaking with my Japanese friends, and some of this might not be completely accurate because they were speaking in Japanese and I was, like an infant in my Japanese comprehension. but it sounded like, you know, there are temples and shrines everywhere. So that's, you know, you mentioned Buddhism. So that is Buddhism, and then Shintoism. That's like really, I think, embedded in their culture. I think for them, the religion is very much in, like, built into the culture. Like one of them said that she was Buddhist and I had no idea, but they still go to shrines, even though they're Buddhist. And, you know, I asked her like, oh, what do you do for this? Like, you know, I feel like in movies and stuff, I see them doing chants. Like, I'm not sure how it's practiced. And she's like, oh, I just go for like big holidays or something, or when I need to pray about something. At least amongst my friends there, it didn't seem like it took like a big role for them. And I think it was just kind of built into their culture and how they approached it. And then for Christianity, I didn't meet a lot of young people who were Christian, but maybe it was because I was like in the boonies. I don't know if it's different in the city. But most of the Christian, like Japanese Christian people that I met at the church I went to were like older people. And I couldn't quite understand their Japanese as well, but I think they probably went to like missionary or Christian schools when they were younger, back during that period of history.
Interesting. It kind of sounds like the culture is, here for Christianity, that there's a lot of people who say they're Christian and but they only go for like Easter and Christmas services. That kind of sounds like your friend's experience with Buddhism and maybe, whatever else they practice, over there. That's really interesting. And so moving more into, your authorship, being an author and writing, where do you draw your inspiration and writing style from?
Yeah. And like, every time you say author, it just like gives me chills sometimes. Cause you're like, oh, like,
that's really me.
Yeah. Where I draw my inspiration from, for at least for this book that I'm in the process of editing, you know, I'm working with my publisher on that. I think the initial source of it was from like dreams. I just like dreamt a lot as a child. Do you guys dream still? And do you remember your dreams?
Sometimes. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's just like, I remember, cause sometimes you wake up and you're like, oh, I just dreamt of something, and it just slips like through your fingers. And you're like, oh my gosh. So I started writing like right after I wake up. I'm like, okay, let's just write it down so I have a hold of it. And also when I was a kid, I think my parents or probably some, no, actually not my parents. I think some kids at school who were just playing around with me were like, hey, if you don't tell your dreams, they're going to come true. And I'm like, oh, it's like the same thing as like blowing out the candles on a cake, right? It's like, oh, you don't tell anyone your wish so that it comes true. Have you guys heard of that? Or was it just me? Okay.
Yeah. You're not alone.
But yeah, so I think they said that, and then like they applied it to dreams and like, oh, if you keep your dream a secret, it's going to come true. And so I was like, I don't want to keep it a secret. Like I have nightmares. I would write about it. And then From there, you know, dreams don't make sense. So I don't think it could make like a book, but other inspirations are definitely from like anime, because anime is kind of ridiculous and also just really fun. And I feel like anime has just a huge breadth of topics that it hits on, different types of characters, including animation as well. Animations are really cool too. Yeah, there's a lot to draw from there. And also I just watch a lot of it. So I think naturally I pulled a lot from there. For this book specifically, I think a lot is also pulled from books I read in childhood. So have you guys read like the Golden Compass series?
Oh, yeah. Well, I don't think I read the books, but I know I saw there's a movie that came out a while back.
Yeah, with like Nicole Kidman, right?
Yeah, I think so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So like that, because they're traveling in different worlds in that. There's the Narnia series. Did you guys read that?
Love Narnia.
Yes.
I've read it multiple times now.
Yeah. Love it. And so I think a lot is drawn from that. There's a bit of dystopia in what I'm writing right now. And so I think the big dystopian book is 1984, George Orwell. So yeah, I think a lot of those books, and Harry Potter is just a classic YA, like magical story. I didn't pull like concepts from there per se, but in terms of like structuring and how in depth the characters were, like I thought that was a great place to kind of pull inspiration from.
Yeah, the character development in Harry Potter is really, really good. They make you, J.K. Rowling did a really good job of making you want to engage with the characters and really care about the characters, which was really good. You don't always get that.
Yeah. And it's not just like Harry. Mm-hmm. It's like Ron Weasley had his own story. Hermione has her own story. So it's cool. It's like everyone's a rounded character.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Yeah. I love that. So how did you get into writing? And well, I guess you just explained all of that. I just realized. I take that back.
I like to journal. And my major in university was history and Asian studies. And that requires a lot of writing. I think even in high school, I really enjoyed creative writing. Sometimes when I'm like cleaning out my old room at my parents' house, you'll find like old, like school things. Has that happened to you guys? You find like old things that you've written or done. Yeah. It's like a time capsule. And I found like this old thing I wrote like in high school about this dilapidated house with like a stain on the floor. And you don't know what that stain is. And I'm like, oh my gosh, who was I?
That's funny. Yeah. Some of the things you write in the past, you're like, ooh, where'd that come from?
Yeah. You're like, did I need a therapist back then?
Most kids, I would say, not just you.
And going along with your writing, you're currently working on publishing the book, though we talked about a little bit, and that is called The Vending Portal. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yes. So The Vending Portal is a YA book. I'm thinking like middle school, high school, but obviously also for adults who enjoy that genre. And it's about like multiple universes. It follows these three middle schoolers slash elementary student who stumble upon a different world. I would say very similar to like The Wardrobe and The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. They find themselves in another world, very unfamiliar. And then they find out that their family is kind of intertwined in this other world. And and this other world is just really cool, very advanced, and also just slightly dystopian. And so it's like, figuring out their way through it. And I just hope it's like, I hope it's a book on friendship and also, I mean, with everything that's happening in the world today, right? It's hopefully I want it to kind of start discourse on, you know, what makes a quote unquote perfect world. It doesn't exist, right? Or a perfect society, but it's like what's important in a society, like people's different point of views and where they're coming from and why they're doing these actions.
Yeah. Did you ever, so growing up, I'm guessing you read young adult books, right?
Yes.
Yeah. So I did too, obviously. I love those. The fantasy young adult genre is really cool. And a lot of times I found myself thinking, this is supposed to be like a middle schooler. Can they really do all of this? Did you ever find that to be true when you're reading those books?
Yeah. I'm like, wow, they're doing a lot. And same with anime, right? They're like always middle schoolers or high schoolers. Right? And I'm like, what?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The one I'm thinking of is, oh my gosh, what's the name of the show? Takemichi is the main character.
Tokyo Revengers.
Yes, Tokyo Revengers. They are supposed to be in middle school.
And I don't believe it for 1 minute.
What? These kids are having these like knockdown, drag out fights that are so intense. And you're I don't know. I'm not sure I believe that you're really in middle school.
I know. Same with like Pokemon or Yu-Gi-Oh, right? Like they're at like teenagers or tweens maybe.
Yeah. Yeah. So much going on. And I love the idea of the vending portal being, it sounds kind of similar in a way to what we're going to be talking about a little bit later. Is that true with like bending powers?
Oh,
or well, not so much?
Not so much. It's very literal. Okay. Just vending machine. And I guess a part of that is inspired by just me living in Japan. They have vending machines everywhere.
Oh, that's where the name came from. Okay. That makes a lot more sense.
Yeah. And like even in the middle of nowhere, there's this vending machine that for some reason works and they're incredible. You can get like hot drinks during the winter from it. I love them. And so, yeah, basically they will enter like worlds through a vending machine. That's why it's a vending portal. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I mean, apparently there's like all different kinds of vending machines all over the world. Really strange ones. What's the strangest vending machine, since we're talking about them, that you have ever seen?
I know Japan has a bunch of very unique ones.
Yeah.
And I've seen videos that they have like pasta ones, ramen ones, like, oh, there's beer ones. There's beer vending machines.
Oh my goodness.
I have no idea how they're like age checking through that, but those exist. For me, there was this vending machine where everything's like wrapped up so you don't know what it is. And it's $20. So it's almost like
a mystery vending machine.
Yeah. A mystery vending machine. And so you don't know what you're going to get. And it's also $20, which is kind of a lot. And usually it's like a keychain or something, but it's like on the off chance you get something really nice. So that's like, I guess, kind of like the most unique one or weird one that I've used myself.
Interesting. Did you get a keychain when you did it?
Yeah, it was a keychain. Yeah. And it wasn't even cute. It was like this really kind of scary teddy bear thing. Oh. I thought it was like possessed. I was like, I don't know.
We're going to give this one away.
Yeah. Regift.
Yeah. I was like, I can't throw it away. I must regift. Yeah.
Yeah. $20. Woo.
And since we're talking about Japan and we touched on anime a little bit, tell us a bit about really like, I guess like your top three or your current anime that you're into.
Oh my gosh. Top three. Okay. So there's this kind of unknown series called Yakitate Japan. For reference, have you guys heard of Food Wars?
Yes.
Yes.
Love Food Wars.
Yes.
Okay.
This one especially.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Oh my gosh. But yeah, so it's kind of similar to Food Wars in that they're having cook-offs, but it's like bake-offs because they're baking bread. And then the judges will always have like a reaction to the bread.
Like in Food Wars, all their clothes just go off, right?
I know. Yeah. So yeah, it's more PG in Yakitate Japan, okay, where they're just like, whoa. And a lot of it is like wordplay and puns in their reaction. So I like that. Yakitate Japan is one of my top. I think I have to say, I really liked Full Metal Alchemist Brotherhood. It's really good. And I love JoJo's Bizarre Adventures, which I mentioned to you guys right before we recorded, but it follows like a family of these like incredible people. And it's just kind of ridiculous because they're all striking poses and fighting. I like ridiculous shows. So I really like those. What about you guys?
Oh man.
Oh gosh. There's been quite a few.
Recently we've been going back through Shield Hero again.
Yeah. We just finished it last night so that we can start the second season.
Oh, well, I think we have like 1.5 episodes left.
Oh, okay.
We fell asleep. It was late.
Is it that good if you're falling asleep?
Well, it was like midnight.
Yeah.
So I was like, yeah.
So yeah, that one's good.
Demon Slayer, of course, is always a great
always
one.
The top. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Spy Family right now is excellent.
Yes.
Oh my gosh. Everyone is recommending Spy Family to me. I need to start it.
Yeah. It's not just a bunch of hype. It is really good.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Sometimes you're like, okay, it's too much hype here, but no, it actually is really good. It's cute. Okay. It's like this, makeshift little family that happens to be imperfect and yet perfect. It's great.
Love it.
Yeah, but I think those would be our top. I know that there's like a lot of new anime series that I'm trying to get into. I think the last new one that I've started is A Couple of Cuckoos, which is about two people, boy and a girl, who were switched at birth. So their parents are not their biological parents. And it starts out that the girl that this guy meets is the daughter of his biological parents. And whoa, there's this whole like arranged marriage thing. Like, so they want to keep it all in the family. And I'm like, but I mean, it is very comedic. I've only watched a couple episodes, so I can't really recommend it at this point, but it shows promise, I guess.
Okay. That's interesting. You know, I just thought of one that I have not watched yet, but I think would be really cool to watch. And I'm curious if you guys have watched it before. I forgot the name of it, but it's the one where, like, I think Jesus and Buddha are roommates. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. So I can't find that on like Crunchyroll or anything, but I have heard of it. And I know there are clips on YouTube. That would be a very interesting one to watch. But yeah, because you have these like two diametrically opposed, you know, faiths and representations. So yeah, one thing that like we watched, I don't know if you've seen it because it came out in theaters in January and had a run in the U.S. for like a few weeks, but it was called Belle.
Yeah, that was great.
I've never heard of this. What is it about?
So it is about this girl who through a traumatic event. She used to love the scene, but like she doesn't sing anymore. She's kind of in the background and she has a couple friends, but she kind of like keeps to herself. Well, she gets into this like quote unquote like social network called the World of You.
It's and, like a virtual reality type of a game, I guess.
Whoa. Kind of like Sword Art Online.
Yes.
In a way.
Yeah, in a way.
Yeah, but not necessarily fantasy.
Yeah. Not, yeah,
more of like
not
a fully. Social network.
And she creates this character named Belle, and this is a way to get her scene out there, and she meets, it's a little bit reminiscent of Beauty and the Beast. It has that one element of it, but it's a very original story.
It's really, really good. It much deeper than you would think it would be. Then again, I mean, it's anime. Anime, like, dives real deep pretty quick.
It's a movie?
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. Yep. Okay. It's available to buy or rent on iTunes and I think Amazon as well.
Mm-hmm. Huh. Interesting. Yeah. Maybe like particularly salient with, aren't they trying to like kick off the metaverse or something where like you can go in this universe? I don't know.
Yeah. Well, no, there are people who are buying land and starting businesses in the metaverse.
What?
It's already happening.
Yeah.
The idea I think one day is that the reason why businesses are buying these land and like building buildings, they're like, it's crazy. They're buying like plans of buildings from architects and building these buildings in the metaverse. Anyway, the idea is apparently to have this virtual conference space where you can come in from your home and still be like you're together in the office in a way. So
it's
like,
very much, you know, when you mention Sword Art Online, it's very much a full dive type of mentality.
Right. Whoa. What's funny to me is when I finally understood what it was, I was like, oh, I mean, that idea has been around for like a long time. All the gamers know exactly what's going on here. And people who are non-gamers or not in the anime community, they don't know. They're like, wow, it's this new thing. And you're like, no, I mean, it's cool that we can do it now, but like, it's not a new concept.
Yeah.
So I think we are ready to get into our topic for today. And Judy, what is the work we will be discussing?
we'll be talking about The Legend of Korra, specifically book two.
Earth, fire, air, water. Only the Avatar can master all four elements and bring balance to the world.
So if that sounds familiar for those of you who may have not seen Legend of Korra, but saw Avatar The Last Airbender, it was a series on Nickelodeon, and this was also on Nickelodeon as well. I actually did not see like this type of quote-unquote connected series until like a few years ago, actually.
Oh, yeah. We watched Avatar The Last Airbender and Legend of Korra. That was the first time you'd seen either, right?
Yes, it was.
Oh, okay, wow. Same for me. Yeah, it was only a year or two, a couple years ago, something like that. So yeah, it's very exciting.
Well, I think when I saw the trailer for like Avatar The Last Airbender, it was like when I was like graduating high school, I think.
Are you talking about the live action movie?
No, not that. Oh. Because that was like much later.
Was it?
Yeah.
Okay. My timeline's all messed up.
Yeah, it was in the 20 teens, I know for sure.
For the TV series?
Yes.
Okay.
But yeah, but I mean, I loved it. I really enjoyed it. With The Legend of Korra, I really like how it was its own story and not really just, oh, this is a sequel for, you know, Aang and everything.
Yeah, I would definitely say I really enjoyed that part. What were your favorite parts of Korra as a general whole?
I think with Korra, it definitely felt more grown up too compared to like Avatar The Last Airbender. And I don't know if they did it on purpose because probably the audience that was first watching Avatar has grown up. So I don't know if they were doing that on purpose. I mean, similarly to Harry Potter, right? Like over the several books, like it got darker and darker and older. What I liked about Korra, I mean, in the first season, I thought it was just really cool to see how that world they created has developed over time. For me, I think some of my favorite parts of Korra was seeing like, oh, Republic City and like how it's formed and now metal bending is a thing everywhere. And then like kind of revisiting our favorite characters from Avatar, but like through their descendants, like, oh, Tenzin. Oh my gosh. Like it's like Tuff's descendant. So I think those were kind of like my favorite moments.
Yeah, I liked that it was a nod to the original characters, and some of the original characters came back and they were older, and that was cool to be able to see. But yeah, it was its own thing. It was nice to know what happened to the characters too after it was over, because it was like, yay, everything's happy. Obviously, you know, things happen after the end of a series. So it was nice to be able to see that. I agree.
Yeah. And like to that, I think it's also very realistic in that, like, obviously at the end of Avatar The Last Airbender, they killed the big bad guy or, you know, neutralized him. Not didn't kill him. They neutralized him. And then, you know, they work towards creating a more peaceful world. And then you see in Korra's time period, the results of like Zuko's and Aang's work. And you see it's not resolved. And you're like, oh.
Yeah.
That's pretty realistic. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's very realistic of what goes on. You think about causes and things in the past that have tried to take shape and change culture. And it's like some of it changed and there were positive moves forward, but not completely. There's still like years and years and years of history that needs to be kind of like rewritten, not rewritten, but like people need time to change. And it doesn't happen overnight.
Yeah, it's true. It's like the intention is good. Maybe execution takes time, or like execution could have been better.
And we're all human. We make mistakes, right?
And speaking of Republic City, that's one of our, well, it's a an item in one of our talking points about like how society grows and the culture changes and everything. And kind of like the secularization I guess, faith and religion as it pertains to Legend of Korra. And with the Republic City, in Avatar The Last Airbender, it was seen that, you know, bending, water bending, air bending, whatever it might be, it was like, oh, wow, you can do this. But in Republic City, it's very much, I guess you would say, demonized. Because we have the Equalist Party who just wants, well, everybody should be able to do this. We we can't let these, you know, vendors, you know, be so high and mighty.
Yeah. It's like bending is normalized and at the same time is secularized.
Yeah. No, I think it's a really great, like tie, right? It was like bending was not only normalized, but commercialized, right? There was like pro bending. It's like, ooh, now we can watch it for sport, which I think is also like kind of a nod to our human history, right? Where like people used to just do things to survive. And now it's like, oh, we're so comfortable that we can have sports. Like sports is really something that you can only have when you're, I feel like, in a good place for entertainment. But yeah, I agree. Yeah, they try to like equal it out. They have like science and inventions to like balance the scales, so to speak. It's not as revered, as you said.
Yeah, I like too that in Avatar, it was very, this is not the right phrase. There's a better phrase, but not as, not civilized, but like not as progressed, I guess, in technology.
Right.
There's a right term. What is the right term?
Modernization.
Thank you.
Yes, because in Avatar the Last Airbender, it's very, dystopian isn't the right word.
You're struggling too, Josh.
It's very much older, I'll just say an older version of the world.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, in Legend of Korra, it's very much, they have some of that, you know, in the water tribe still, but in Earth, Republic City, it's very much modernized, what we would see today, almost. Mm-hmm. But
well, it was like it was set in the,
like the 20s, almost. Yeah, the 1920s. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Which is a really cool style choice, in my opinion.
Yeah,
because they've got cars, planes and robots and all kinds of fun things.
Right. And what they call movers, which, you know, in our world is movies.
That's why I think it's the 20s.
Yeah.
It's very much like the industrialization.
And with talking about like these secularization in relation to faith, I think in Christianity particularly, there was a point in time where we took this, again, still revered, but more so solemn and serious faith aspect, and we commercialized it. Again, we have books, we have the coffee shops in a lot of the churches, and we have CDs, music, and it's...
Mega churches.
Yes, yeah. Mega churches. Again, Hillsong being one of them, Bethel, another one as well. And I think it takes away, I mean, not trying to be controversial, but I think it takes away from the true meaning when you have all these other things surrounding it. I mean, would either of you agree with that or disagree?
Well, I think it it takes away if you focus too much on it. You know, I don't think those things are inherently bad. Having a bookshop in your church, I was pretty cool actually, because then you know where you can go to like source good books that your church recommends. That's cool. You know, you have a coffee shop in your church. Awesome. You can just have a nice place to go get fancy coffees before you go into service.
Early morning service. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But I think if you, it's remembering that it's not a business, it is a church, I think is important. I know for like our church, we've got a coffee shop in our church, and they use the proceeds to go towards I think it's an addiction center where they help.
Place of Hope.
Yeah. They help people get out of addiction, which is really cool. So I think it can take away if done inappropriately, but I think it can also enhance. I think it's okay.
Yeah, I've wondered if it's like kind of meant to initially like draw people in, perhaps, because, you know, a bookstore is cool. Coffee is enticing. I've had like Christians and non-Christians alike talk to me how churches are very interesting to them these days, or as of the last several years, because a lot of popular churches focus a lot on like songs, right? Like, you know, exercising your faith through song. And some of them have really incredible like production value. There's like lights, there's like projections, a whole band. So people have wondered like about that to me. And I feel like, at least in that aspect, they do it because it's kind of, maybe it's easier to reach out to people through song. Like song is something that a lot of people can enjoy. And then perhaps like you spread the word through song. But I'm just curious, like maybe these methods are ways to draw people in first. And then you, as you said, Rebecca, like just as long as they're not focusing on it, it's not like their main thing. Yeah.
Yeah, most definitely. I mean, it's about, you know, changing the method, not necessarily the message. Is something I've heard a lot of. But secularization at its core is replacing religious values and traditions with non-religious values and traditions. And I think that's where you kind of enter into muddy waters when that starts entering a place of faith or religious tradition. Relating this back to Cora, we see this with the quote-unquote festival, the ceremony that takes place in the Water Tribe.
Yeah.
And we have Master Ren, starts with an R. Well, he's a bad guy in book two.
Yeah.
And
Cora's uncle.
Yes.
Yeah. Like Torlock, right? Or was it?
Yeah.
Or was it Unalaq?
Unalaq? Yes.
One of the two.
One of those, yes.
Yeah.
And I'll play the sound clip here, but Master Unalaq, he is talking about like how it used to be, where he says, oh, you know, this used to be so serious and revered, and now it's just turned into, you know, quote unquote, be like a circus. So I'll play that a little bit.
It's a shame the Southerners have abandoned all connections to the spirits, even during the most hallowed times.
I've always loved the Glacier Spirits Festival. It's fun.
This festival used to be a solemn time of fasting and meditation. Now it's just a chance to watch some rube try to stick an entire Arctic hen in his mouth.
It's a great place to stop.
Yeah. I think, and there's, you know, Josh, you mentioned before you played the clip, a carnival. There are some churches who literally bring a carnival on stage. I'm pretty sure it was a Hillsong church who did that once. But there was like a roller coaster on stage where like the pastors came in on the roller coaster thing, and there were like elephants and it like, okay, that's too far. This is just pure entertainment now, and this is not church.
You know, where's that money from?
from the people, probably. So it's,
well, it also, and I think all of us may have this growing up when we went to church. It's like, oh, well, we're not going to have a Halloween party. We're going to call it a fall festival. And essentially it was just trunk or treat as it's known today. And I think one of our friends is like, yeah, you know, one of the rooms, like we had as like, the Sorting Hat room. I'm like, from Harry Potter?
And a church? That seems odd.
Yeah, and it's like you do you. So,
It's really sad though to see in Cora that, like Unalaq was saying, it used to be a very spiritual time and all of that, and now it's just a way to have fun. And how sad that is. That is what, because they lost their connection to the spirit world and the spiritual aspect of what was real, more real than this fun festival. Yeah, it's fun, but like you're forgetting the spiritual realm that you're connected to. The same could be said for us today, of if you have all the hype and the festival and the fun and the carnival, you're potentially sacrificing that connection to the spiritual realm. And what good is that ultimately doing?
Yeah. I think they focus a lot like on balance in book two, right? They're like, oh, like, you know, it's falling out of balance, which is why all these dark spirits are coming. But I think also we can see this change, not only within the time period, or maybe the time period is affecting like the main characters, but within the struggles that like Aang had and the struggles that Korra has. And I don't know if it's a nature of the fact that Aang was like an airbender and they were like pretty spiritual. I think they were based off of like Tibetan monks or something. But like you see, Aang had no problems with his spirituality being the avatar, right? I think with him, he just struggled to like with his own personality to have to like own up and take accountability. But with Korra, like she mastered like three of the elements already. She was an incredible fighter. She kind of butted her head into things as I guess the Avatar does. I personally feel like she sometimes shouldn't have, but it's fine.
I would agree with that. Sometimes it's too much.
Right. But then she, like her big struggle was, I think, spirituality. And I don't know if that was like reflection of the times on her, right? Where like they were losing spirituality. And that's why she struggled with that being the Avatar, because spirituality was, I feel like it's pretty pivotal in the Avatar role.
Yeah. Well, she, as we find out in the book, book two, she is meant to be, as the Avatar, the connection between the spirit world and their world. Mm-hmm. And like, that's her purpose to being the Avatar, is to bring harmony to both. And by not being able to connect, she lost a huge part of who she was. But what a great character development when she finally did realize.
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that also affected her abilities as the Avatar, where she wasn't able to connect to that part of her. So when you said she lost a big self, like big part of herself because of that, I think, you know, I think manifested wise, like when it came to her bending, she relied a lot on emotions. And then later, as she developed, she became more connected, just became overall a better Avatar, being able to use her abilities to like the maximum.
Yeah, exactly.
And speaking of, you know, the term Avatar, let's speak on kind of what religions this kind of mixes in the series. So Taoism is a very big influence in both Avatar the Last Airbender and also Legend of Korra. And Taoism, for those of you who don't know, and I want to thank Judy for doing a good bit of research for today's episode. Again, this is from Wikipedia. I'll just read a little bit of it. So for Shinto and Taoism, kind of the two together, it's the supernatural entities that lead to inhabit all things. So when we were talking a little bit earlier about the shrines, the different tangible items that, you know, we go to the shrine to, you know, to pray or to ask for things. And so, Judy, I'm interested to hear, like, your thoughts. I mean, I know that none of us subscribe to Taoism in particular, mm-hmm. but Judy, how do you think this all correlates in this series?
Yeah, that's a great question. So yeah, you're right. I'm not like a Taoist. I don't follow Shintoism, but like through my studies, I did read into it back in university because I focused on pre-modern China. And during that time, like a lot of like Confucian facets and Taoist facets were like a big part of that sort of that society at the time. And I think even today you can see like parts of that in it. But no, I agree with you where I feel like in the Avatar world and Korra, I don't know if the writers were inspired by it, but I do think it ties to like Shintoism, like you said, where they believe that there is a spirit or something connected to like all these different items. You go to different gods for different things. You go to different shrines to pray for different things. There are shrines for childbirth. There are shrines for like having great grades. They sell like amulets for all sorts of different things. And I think in Korra, right, there are all these different spirits for different things. So that, you know, seems to have a tie to that. As for Taoism is a lot about like harmony. I'm sure you guys have seen, right, the yin yang symbol.
Right.
Is from like Taoism. And I think I just with Avatar and the Korra series talking so much about harmony and balance, I think it really closely ties to Taoism emphasis on the way and going with the flow of like some sort of cosmic energy, and like light versus dark, yin versus yang. And I think especially in book two, which is called Spirits for Korra, with the story of Rava and Vatu, they talk about how like, even if Rava's gone, like a bit of her is going to be inside Vatu for you to pull out and like same. And then we literally see Korra pull Rava out of Vatu, I think, in their ultimate cosmic fight. And I think it's really similar to at least the image of that yin yang image where it's like black and white swirls and it has like the opposite colored dot within each one, right? There's like a seed of each within both and together they're in harmony. So that's how I see like those schools of spirituality tying into Korra.
Well, it's interesting too that in a way to me, Rava and Vatu kind of resemble the yin yang symbol, even with like the way that they're shaped. They're very like large at the top and then kind of get small with a tail at the bottom.
Yeah. I agree. Especially when they're fighting too, right? When they go into the story of Wan, the first avatar, and they see them fighting and they're like, you know, they're together and they're like tumbling around. I can totally see that.
Yes. And getting into actually that, that's kind of like one of our main focuses is light and dark in the relation to Rava and Vatu. And we see this in the story of the first avatar, Wan. One thing I appreciate is the animation style kind of like changed a bit when they were telling the story.
Yep.
And Wan, you know, kind of reminded, he had like Aladdin qualities in the first, where he's just running from guards, stealing stuff and
bread specifically. I was like, okay, that's exactly what Aladdin did.
he wants like something more. He doesn't want to be like this person who just steals all the time. And so he joins this quote unquote team, army, to go out and, I guess round up all these like different like spirits, and he gets the power of, you know, fire bending, from this, tiger shrine, I guess you would say.
Lion turtle.
And he's basically forgotten about or like left behind from the team, the army. And he goes to live among the spirits so that he can have, you know, forms that connection. Because during that time of Wan, the spirits are very reluctant to have Wan and have it light their land. Because one of the spirits says, you know, I've never seen a human. You have no regard for us. And all you brought is like destruction. But then Wan like ends up saving a spirit from this army team, and the, I forget his name, it's like
a lemur looking spirit.
He's a little scary looking, just saying.
Yeah,
he's like, oh, don't know about him.
And he's like, well, you know, I've never seen a human, you know, stand up for a spirit like that. So you can come and I've never had a human as a pet, so I'll call you Stinky. It's like, it's Wan. It's like, I prefer to call you Stinky.
Yeah, it was awesome that they ended up becoming friends and actually learning about each other rather than just being scared of each other.
But the reason why I want to bring up Wan, the first avatar, is because when he encounters this struggle and this fight between Rava and Vatu, it kind of reminded me of like when, quote unquote, like sin entered the world, because you have Vatu kind of being cunning and lying to Wan about, oh, you know, I've been tormented, you know, you set me free, all is going to be right. And it's kind of like, you know, Satan telling Eve, it's like, oh, God didn't really say this, you should go ahead and eat the apple, it's fine. And then it's just all the trouble started then.
If you're a friend to spirits, then use your fire to help me break free.
Don't involve the human. This is between us.
Please, save me. She has tormented me for 10,000 years.
10,000 years? Let him go!
He had no idea what he just did.
Yeah.
Oh, I still like shudder hearing that, like, oh no, what are you doing?
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because again, the reason that they're struggling is they've done that throughout forever. I mean, and that it's always the struggle between good and evil. And when talking about yin and yang, light and dark, I believe at face value, there is truth to that, that to have balance, we do need a little bit of that, because we all have
balance. We need what?
Light
and dark.
Light and dark, yes. Because just as the day and the night, we all have a light side and we have a dark side, but we have to choose like what side of that is the majority of us.
Well, I think to dig deeper into what you're saying, there is both light and dark in the world. Mm-hmm. As humans, I believe before Christ, we cannot do anything but evil. We are inherently evil because sin has taken over and killed and cut off that spiritual connection that we have with God, which is why we need Jesus to come in and make us a completely new creation and offer that connection to God, to the spiritual world again. And only then can we choose goodness and light, because we are called to put off the old man and put on the new. And that, I think, is where the struggle comes in for the Christian.
I think of it maybe similarly to kind of what Taoist schoolings are, in terms of like people are both like light and dark. Light and dark makes the whole like two sides of the same coin.
Finding light in dark, we kind of like see this at the harmonic convergence, this big thing that's like talked about for like most of the season in book two. Is it really okay? When I think of like harmonic convergence, I didn't see any like harmony honestly until the end. But it's like this big battle where you think all like hope is lost, because we see Rava just like get blown, they're like smithereens.
Pummeled, yeah.
Yeah. And then I have this clip here where Korra is in a last effort to like know what to do. And we have this like flashback to Rava having this conversation with Juan.
If you and Vatu have the same fight every 10,000 years, why hasn't one of you destroyed the other?
He cannot destroy light any more than I can destroy darkness. One cannot exist without the other.
Find the light in the dark.
And that's what it's all about. Again, the yin and yang, there's a little bit of each in either one.
Yeah, I see what you're talking about now. I was thinking about it from a different perspective of, but like in general, good things happen and bad things happen. That's sort of the light and the darkness. And you can always find light in the dark.
Yeah.
And looking at it from that perspective, yeah, you do need each other. You cannot appreciate the light without the dark. And likewise, it makes it better.
Yeah.
Or no, enhances, I guess. I don't know.
Romantic?
No, it enhances.
Oh, I heard romantic, and I was like, oh.
No.
I mean, there could be fan fiction on Batu and Rava. Who knows?
Oh, I'm sure it's out there. I'm sure. We all remember being in middle school reading that fan fiction.
Oh, yeah. Good old fan fiction.
Oh, gosh. Well, I think we've kind of covered everything as far as our talking points. Judy, was there anything that you wanted to add in or make sure that we covered?
I don't think so. I do think we like covered a lot on, yeah, secularism, the different faiths within Korra, light and dark, how this is tied to like what we see today. Yeah, I think we touched on a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. And for those of you who don't know, we do have a YouTube channel. It is pretty recent. So if you want to see the full conversation, go to our YouTube channel and you'll find our full conversation and interaction with Judy Liu. Judy, before we wrap up, if people want to follow you and kind of see what you're up to, how can they find you?
Yes, thank you. So my author Instagram account, follow me on Instagram at Judy Liu, JUDYLIU _ author, AUTHOR. I know it's not like really creative, but my publisher was like, just do that. And I was like, okay. So there's that. You can also reach out to me via email, judy@thevendingportal@gmail.com. I'm not super high tech right now, but I think those are the main ways. And the book comes out like later this year, if all goes well, and you'll be able to see it on like Amazon and Barnes and Noble at the time. But currently going through copy editing right now.
It's exciting.
Yeah, they're really exciting.
It really is.
Well, we hope everyone has enjoyed our conversation with Judy and also talking about Legend of Korra. Again, if you like this episode, go ahead and comment on our social media. Again, we can be found on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. And if you really like our podcast, go ahead and give us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. And until next time, keep those halos shiny and stay holy, my friends.
Bye, everybody.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Anneluia podcast. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to keep up with all the latest information. We would love to hear your comments and questions about today's episode, as well as suggestions for future episodes. You can message us on our socials or email us at contact@anneluia.com.